entire group to come to attention. Time.
Thank you very much. That was really nice. Excuse me, Bob. This may be of some interest to you. We have a news note, the kind of stuff that Lyle Van just doesn't put on. A little tidy one. I'm thinking of doing a whole series of programs entitled The Kind of News That You Really Just Don't Hear Nowhere. I mean, you know, the inhuman side of the news. Yes, it's from Maceió, Brazil. Incendia Costino da Lira, a Brazilian once billed as the fattest woman in the world, died recently in Palmeira dos Indios. The bereaved husband, who had to sell his farm to keep her in food, said after her death, "I cannot understand it. She was like a bottomless pit. She ate all the time, 24 hours a day. I am going broke. I am dead. I am bankrupto." The bottomless pit is gone. I mean, I just like that description. And the headline reads, "Bottomless pit dies." Now, wait a minute. Now, you know, in this age of the Weight Watcher and all that, I like the idea of somebody who's just bottomless. Guy has to sell his farm to keep her in the Rice Krispies and, you know, whatever else she ate, pizza and stuff. But I had an experience. Now, wait a minute, gang. Don't laugh at this. People who are bottomless pits are not necessarily fat. In fact, quite obviously the opposite. At one period in my life, and I'll put it bluntly to you, I was in the Army. Now, you know damn well in the Army, you do not have money to squirt around. Not unless you got some kind of a deal on the side going. And I can tell you, it's not easy for a T5 to get a deal on the side going. No way. Right? So, I had about half a month's pay in my pocket, which means that the sides of my pocket were rubbing pretty close together, right? And I had this date. Now, I figured I had enough, though. I had about, you know, $22, $23. I figured I could, if I used judicious thought, I could get by on this thing. And so I had a date, and I'll tell you where it was in case you're interested. It was in Washington, D.C. I will never forget. Every time I go to Washington, I get a sick feeling in the pit of my gut. And not because of Watergate, any of this kid stuff. I'm talking about personal danger. Personal danger. And I had this date, you know, right? And she lived out in Georgetown. You know where Georgetown is? And that she looked a little like Judy Garland in her prime. She, you know, real a small, great-looking girl. And so I picked her up. I figured, well, what the hell, I can afford a cab. You know, it was kind of great. So I had the cab out there, and she comes down. And I said, her name was Effie. I said, "Where'd you like to go, Effie?" I figured, you know, $25. She knows I'm a yard bird. She's not going to say, you know, some place like the Four Seasons or something like that. And I said, "Effie, where would you like to go?" And she's little. See, I've made it a point when you're scratching, when you're really right down there and, you know, it's Tap City, you do not date the bottomless pit. Not unless you're prepared to do some awful fast talking when the check comes around. So here was this little girl. She weighed about 96 pounds, I would say, roughly. Was about maybe 4 feet 11, maybe 5. You know, that a nice handful. You know what I mean? Yeah, you know, the kind you kind of like to keep for a souvenir. You know, have you ever run into girls that just give you that feeling, you know? So anyway, she, you know, she's a great little chick. So I picked her up, and I said, "Where would you like to go, Effie?" She said, no, I'm not dressed for anything really big." And I said, "Oh, great, I'm not either." I was wearing ODs. And, you know, the full dress uniform of a soldier is not really full dress. Not in the proper sense of the word. You understand that. It's kind of a brown-colored, kind of baggy at the knees. It scratched me in the back of the neck. And had these brass things all over the front. So I said to her, "Where'd you like to go?" She said, anyway, any place, you name it. I said, "Great." So we drove down the street, and I made a classic mistake. Watch this. Do not ever ask a cab driver where you should go. You are liable to get plucked like a chicken because you don't know about this guy. He's got all kinds of little deals. So I said, excuse me, hey, cabbie. And he said, yeah, what do you want? I said, you know, a pretty good seafood restaurant, nothing real fancy, but a nice seafood restaurant. Oh, I know the place. I'll take you right there. So we drive through streets. I know nothing about Washington at that period. We go through these various streets and stuff, and we arrive in front of this place. Again, Shepherd's Next Law. Right there. Stay out of any place that has a green canvas marquee extending out over the sidewalk. Do you agree with that, Bob, as an experienced check payer? Especially if it has a name beginning with L-E. Look, the French, you know. La Piscatori, you know, something like that. Look out. Look out. Well, being innocent at that time and spending most of my time in places roughly equivalent to the Chock Full of Nuts, I was not fully cognizant of the dangers that were about to ensue. So I said, is this okay? He said, yeah. They're very good places. Me and my wife, we always come here. It's very good. I'd recommend it. You should ask them for the Lobster Newburg. I said, Lobster Newburg sounds very, very elegant, pretty elegant. Yeah. He says, it's not a bad place. You can afford it. It's not bad. Oh, God. I mean, that's all relative again. So I paid the guy the tag, which was about $4.50. I got it. Already I'm rocking. See, my $23 is now down to $19. To put it into very concise terms, I was dating the bottomless pit. Before that evening was out, I realized that I feigned. Again, there's animal cunning in all of us. The male learns long, hard practice. He learns how to survive. I'm here. I survived. You're here, Bob. You survived. Jerry, you survived a few things. I immediately realized, with animal cunning, that I had to feign indigestion, which I did. I said, God, I don't know what's the matter. My stomach's really upset. I think it was that SOS we had yesterday. I just I don't know what the hell. I'm not going to eat tonight. Just bring me some water and just some water. I'll have a little of your celery, Effie. And she sat opposite me. She sat opposite me and ate for what seemed like 5, 6, maybe 10 hours. Just kept eating, and the guy kept bringing silver plates. And we finally got back out in the darkness under that little green thing. And it was just a lucky, narrow escape. I got out with about 40 cents. It just made it. Have you ever had just enough money in your pocket to pay the bill? That is it. I left them a 30-cent tip, which is all I could do. We got back out on the and I said, hey, Effie, I got a great idea. She says, what? And here she is, you know, this little chick has downed lobster. She's had bouillabaisse. She's washed it down with French Chablis. She's knocked the whole thing down. I said, I got a great idea. How about just for fun? I never do this kind of stuff. how about let's see if we can walk to Georgetown. I mean, she said, that would be a fun idea. Well, we went about 20 feet, and you know, there's some women that have an absolute aversion to walking. Have you noticed some people who just cannot? They're somehow walking is a lowering of status. And she says, I've walked enough. Enough. We went about four doors, you know. And I said, well, we just got started. I want to see Washington. She says, well, I can't walk. She says, my shoes are not. Look at my shoes. And she had these little tiny shoes made of little straps and silver buckles and stuff. And I said, it's been a long time since I've been on a bus. I figured I could spring for a bus. She said, but you have to make 3 transfers to get out there. She had to go by way of Chevy Chase and all those places, which I knew nothing about. It's like going to Staten Island by way of Dutchess County. And I said, I'm taking a bus. I said, hell with it. I'm not going to see this chick anymore. This is it. I said, I'm taking a bus. She says, all right. We got on the bus. We rode in stony silence for about 7 hours. We finally got out to Georgetown. I dumped her off in front of her house. And I walked from Georgetown to the center of Washington, even though it's been 40 miles, to the USO. I walked into the USO, and I hurled myself down in front of them. I mean, you know, just, it's like a... Have you ever paid penitence in your life? Penance? You ever hurled yourself down in front of somebody and think, I want to confess? You ever done that? You have a lot to learn, baby. Joan, you do. When you are reduced to your essentials, the place I had to go to, the camp that I had to go to, was about 60 miles from Washington. I had to make it by midnight. It is now 10:30. There's no way you can do it. So I walk into the USO on my knees, literally, carrying my overseas camp. And I said, I'm in trouble. And this nice lady behind the counter says, what's the trouble, soldier? Would you like a tuna fish salad sandwich? Which is the first thing they try to lay on you in the USO. And I said, no, I don't want no sandwich. I couldn't get myself to say I was really reduced to the basic bones. She says, well, would you like a donut? We have the donuts and coffee tonight. And how would you like to play a game of ping pong with one of the girls here? I said, no, I got to get back to camp. Oh, well, the bus station is only down in the middle of the next block. I said, no, I can't buy the ticket. I'm broke. I have 17 cents. What am I going to do? And her expression changed. Oh, where do you have to go? And I said, I've got to get... And I named this camp, which will remain anonymous, which was out in Virginia and about 60 miles from Washington. That's about $3 on the bus. And then she says, oh, well. And she opened her purse and she gave me three $1 bills. I said, thank you. And I walked out into the night. I mean, and I learned a great lesson. What that lesson is, I don't quite know. But for one thing, beware of bottomless pits. For another thing, I got back to camp, say, I made it by about 8 minutes, and I lay in my bunk, looking up at the ceiling, broke, absolutely stone broke. I could not go out. Now I was done. See, there's no way. You don't go down to the first sergeant and ask him for a loan, you know. An advance on your salary till next month. No way. They don't do that in the Army. So I knew that I was not even going to get outside of the camp for another 2 weeks. That was it. So I lay on my bunk, and next to me is Gasser. He's laying on his bunk. I said, Gasser. He said, yeah, what's up? It's dark. It's after lights out. I said, Gasser, I said, I had a date tonight. And boy, I am really broke. Absolutely broke. He said, where'd you go? I said, I went to this French restaurant, this seafood joint that I asked. He said, did the cab driver tell you about it? I said, yeah, how did you know? He said, oh my God, they're doing it again. And I learned a lot of things as I struggled through life. And one of them is, well, it slipped my mind now. That's the trouble with learning things. They slip your mind, and you'll go right back and do the same thing over and over again. And so, if you will, please, do you have my little thing in there? We would like to salute the mind of man, which has a built-in tape recorder eraser. Have you ever thought of your mind as a tape recorder that records badly sometimes because the heads are dirty, and unfortunately has an intermittent eraser that appears to erase important things. And yet, it never seems to erase totally trivial things. You know, the junk of life. And so we would like to salute that curious quality of the mind of man. Please. And so as the great bands parade, the flags fly, the horns blow, the cannons boom, the reviewing stand glistens in the sun, and the vast battalion of mankind, every last one of us, marches on an eternal parade ground. Chinese, Croatians, Bulgarians, Albanians, Indianans, New Jerseyites, the vast battalion of mankind marches past the eternal judging stand of existence, preparing to execute highly intricate drill precision movements. Oh, Black Hutch, eyes left, eyes front, right, oh, Black Hutch. Dress up that line. Keep that line dressed up and sing it step. Marching to the vast, incomprehensible beat of that enormous John Philip Sousa in the sky. A great battalion of mankind marches on to God knows what destiny. What destination? But what destination is there on a drill ground? There is none except the drill itself. Come on, dress up that line, you guys! Eyes! Right! Eyes! Front! To the left, the bike! Hutch! Forward! Hutch! Double time! Hutch! Hutch! 2, 3, 4! Hutch! 2, 3, 4! Up, 2, 3, 4, up, 2, 3, 4, up, 2, 3, 4, up, 2, 3, 4. Yes, over that vast parade ground of the solar system, mankind executes its intricate drill maneuvers for the unseen command of an unimaginable commander. The subtle irony of that, Joan. That's right. You find yourself lost way down in the 342nd platoon and marching endlessly. But I'll tell you, the one thing that has always baffled me about just walking around in life itself. And I don't want to get too profound at this point in the evening. No way. But there has to be something profound in it. And what it is, I'm not sure. But have you noticed that some people, in fact, I'd say probably the majority of people, are highly unconscious of life itself, the process of life. They don't seem to relate to the fact that they are living and that life is a textual thing. It's really there. Every second of it is there. And every second of it is one more second gone. And other people are highly conscious of this. Now, how that happens, you know, where the two, and they'll come from the same family. There'll be one crowd in a family, I've noticed, that, you know, they just go along and live, you know. Their life consists of going to the store, trying to figure out where they're going to go on a vacation, a lot of yelling about the coffee break, and, you know, and that kind of stuff. And there's always one or two in a small group of people, one or two, who have, I guess, the power of introspection, and who also see themselves in a larger context. Now, these often turn into writers. As a matter of fact, probably the most interesting character in that area that I know of in the field of writing, that is, who was very conscious of time and everything else going on around him, was F. Scott Fitzgerald, who always, even though while he was doing things, always observed himself doing them. That's a curse of the writer. Are you aware of this? And it really is. It's a curse of the writer, the creator, who sees himself, and I have to include myself in spades in this department, who sees himself always doing the things, and yet he sees the thing as a whole. And this bothers people around you when you say, do you realize that what we're doing today is going to be incomprehensible to somebody 800 years from now? And they say, what are you talking about? You know, what the hell? You know, and it's literally true. Now, the things I'm saying to you right now, tonight, and that we often do, will be incomprehensible to people in a few years. I mean, if they, and what we think is we have very few things go on for more than that. Can you imagine somebody, say, looking at a tape of, let's just say, Phyllis Diller in the year 2150 and trying to figure out what in the hell we thought was funny about Phyllis Diller? In fact, that occurs to me all the time anyway. and yet this is people will pay great amounts of money to see this, and they'll go there and they'll sit there and they'll talk about it for weeks. Incomprehensible. But if you point that out, if you say, what is all this about? They think you're some kind of a nut. And I'm just curious. Like the other day, once in a while somebody will come up with something and really say it. I was in a fairly good sized supermarket down in the village. Now there's a lot of people walking around, you know, the supermarket. Everybody down there, there's guys pushing the carts and women walking around, and they have a pet department there. You know, like all supermarkets, you know, they have those collars hanging and rubber bones and stuff like that. So I don't know how it broke out, but one of the clerks, the guy wearing a little straw hat. You know, he looked like the kind of guy that had escaped from the butcher department. And he's wearing a straw hat, he's got a white apron, and he's got a can in his hand, a little can. You know, one of these little cans of food of some kind. See, I wasn't close enough to see what kind of food he had, but it was pet food of some kind, a little can. You know, it's a can about the size of a little can of tuna salad. You know, you buy tuna. Well, you know, that little flat type of can. He's got it, see. He says, "Hey, lady." And she turns and says, "Hmm?" He said, "Hey, lady, do you realize?" And he's looking at it. He says, "Let's see. Let me figure this out now. At the price of this can, do you realize this stuff is $40 a pound? Do you realize your crummy cat is eating stuff that costs $40 a pound?" And there's a little argument. She says, "He says it's $40 a pound. You could go up there and buy 5 steaks for that cat." And he says, $40 a pound of stuff is. And I thought, and I walked on down through the aisle there, see, and I thought, what a great remark. I mean, he really did say it. It's $40 a pound she's paying for stuff that the cat eats, about 9 cans of that stuff a week, you know. And so I walk on down, and of course this caused indignation among many of the ladies there who do not want to be presented with reality. No way. Especially the cat and the dog people. That's a very strange crew. So we walked on, and I'm pushing this thing. See, and I get down to the dairy department. See, and apparently these two women that he had said this to are standing right next to me now. And you could see indignation is radiating from these two ladies. One of them had sort of green hair, and the other had blue hair. And had these net shopping bags. And they were kind of fuming at this thing. And one said to the other, they're looking into the dairy thing, see. And the one said, she said, no, I can't. She said, excuse me, clerk. And there's a guy working in the dairy department. He's messing around. You know, he's putting labels on cheese and stuff like that. And she says, clerk. And he said, yeah, what do you want? Can I help you? And she says, yes, I don't see any seal test pineapple cottage cheese here. You only have the Breakstone pineapple cottage cheese. He says, well, we're out of the seal test. We've got the Breakstone. Oh, okay. And she turned to her friend. She said, Louise, Ralph just will not eat the Breakstone cottage cheese with the pineapple. He just loves the seal test and will not eat the Breakstones. And at that point, Louise says, well, I know how that is. She says, I can't get Tappy to eat. And I realize that Ralph is a damn dandale, that Ralph refuses to eat Breakstones and insists on seal test. And I said to her, I couldn't help it. See, this is the way you get driven out of a community. I said, you mean Ralph, the Airedale, won't eat the Breakstones? And she said, he only the seal test, and he loves the seal test pineapple cottage cheese. And I said, well, have you tried the friendship? That's kind of nice. That's a pretty good friend. Oh, no, he just insists on the seal test. I said, you mean your damn dog? She said, what do you mean? I said, oh, come on. I said, yeah, and I had to do it. I don't want to talk like this. You know, I said, with continents crumbling, with millions dying, I says, Ralph insists on seal test. I said, he probably eats a hell of a lot better than almost everybody living in the village here. She says, well, why shouldn't he? Well, now, that was a question I couldn't answer. You know, at that point, when you're faced with what we call a dialectical conundrum, you kind of like that phrase, don't you, Jim? Well, that has to do with high level debating, which incidentally I was in a debating. I know all these phrases. See, that was a dialectical conundrum where she says, well, why shouldn't he? Well, now if I say, well, he shouldn't eat as well as other people, because in her mind he is a people, I am really recommending starvation. If I say that he should eat better than other people, then I am recommending decadence. So there's nothing you can do. So I said, well, you got a point. You can always get around that by saying, you got a point there. I said, oh, boy. So I turned away. She says, well, there's people like you everywhere. Well, I guess there is. So it was a great moment in the supermarket So I walked out into the sunlight, see, and I walked down the street. And of course, you realize that the dog cuckoos have taken over this world. The dog and the cat cuckoos. It's just absolutely insane. And I would like to point out, may I do something here that's very, very, a very bad taste. Do you mind if I do something in excessively bad taste here tonight? That the indolence and the decadence with which dogs and cats are being treated these days. Have you watched TV commercials? Practically every third commercial is how to coerce your pet into eating this unbelievably expensive glop. You know, it's as if he refuses to eat this stuff. What do you mean? And they have all these commercials where the girl says, oh, I love to watch him eat. Oh, thank God. Oh, thank God. Michael's eating now. And, you know, he's eating Calcan bouillabaisse, you know, with authentic French recipe gravy, and he said, oh, at last I found something the little deer will eat. Well, that's fascinating. The dog and the cat, in other words, is given, at no point do you ever see a scene where a husband or a wife, for example, or let's just say a husband, where the woman says, oh, I'm so glad that Charlie, they eat all these, you know, these hamburger helper stuff. They mix up the hamburger with some beans, and they say, hey, that's pretty good, you know. So obviously, men do not have nearly the taste of your average Doberman Pinscher. He certainly doesn't have the nicety of the gourmet attitude of the average alley cat. No way, because men are always seen on TV, males, I'm talking about in this case. Women never. Always males are saying, well, I'm just a meat and potatoes man. And, boy, I sure love this hamburger helper. You mix it up with the hamburger, and it's really good. You know, he's only shown doing this. No way. Can you imagine foisting that off on, saying, your average blooded dachshund? No way. Not in TV. And so the next day, I went back, see, and here's this little guy. He's still putting stuff on the shelves. And I couldn't help but see him walk past him. I walked past him, see, and I said, hey, excuse me. He said, yeah, what do you want? And I said, you just don't say them things, buddy. He said, what things? What? You know, he forgot all about what? What? I said, $40 a pound for cat food. He said, yeah, ain't that nutty? He says, these old dames come in and he says, oh, let me tell you one time. He said, what come in and he says, I'm working back in the butcher department, see? One comes in and says, I only want tenderloin tips. And you come in, you give me that stuff and any of that gristle in there, and he won't eat. I said, what's the matter? You got a husband who won't eat that? He says, no, what do you mean a husband? It's my German shepherd. He's got to have tenderloin tips cut from the end. It's got to be cut just right.
I says, gee, you know, you ever see the dog?
Oh, yeah, come in there once in a while. I said, you should see that big old mean mother. I said, he's the kind of dog that eats tires off the back of a Mack truck if you let him do it.
I see you thinking, man. There was something going there.
He said, oh, these nutty old dames come in here, you know, what are you going to tell me? He said, let me tell you about the one who used to come in here with a parakeet.
I said, what happened to that one?
At that point, the manager came over and says, hey, Clifford, come on, I want you to back. Well, I'll tell you the next time you come in.
I'd love to know the story of the parakeet. The decadent parakeet, living the indolent life of the French royalty. Quietly lolling away his life to the sound of stereo music, perfumed air, his own little air conditioner, eating imported chestnut seeds, quite possibly from Thailand. That's all he is. He does not like the Iranian chestnut seeds. Refuses to tolerate them. Good night, Maurice, wherever you are.